From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made when the CDC published updated recommendations for preparing for holiday celebrations. In 2020, many of us stayed home and away from vulnerable family especially. That was before widespread vaccination. But now the CDC writes about the concern about the Delta variant. New guidelines recommend outdoor or virtual Thanksgiving and Hanukkah and Christmas celebrations in 2021 over and above indoor gatherings. And if we're being honest here, most Americans are going to hear that and say, no way, we're not doing another Zoom Christmas. Here's another way to think about that. What matters most to you, and how do you evaluate risk? Maybe your vaccinated but aging parents think it's best to continue to act with extreme caution, and that is understandable. Maybe your vaccinated but aging parents are like my mother. If I called her to say that I was not coming in for Christmas, all out of a desire to protect her health, she would drive to Rochester and slap me. Everyone is different, but with better data and a growing capacity to evaluate risk tolerance, we can make decisions that are best for us. And that is at the heart of a new piece from Dr. Lucy McBride. Writing in The Atlantic, McBride says, quote, from a decision-making perspective, we're starting to reach the acceptance phase of the pandemic, a time when we must recalibrate our individual risk gauges, which have been completely thrown out of whack. The approach I'm embracing with patients boils down to a secular version of the serenity prayer. We need the serenity to accept the things we cannot change, courage to change the things we can, and the wisdom to know the difference, end quote. Dr. McBride goes on to say, quote, doctoring isn't about walling off patients from certain exposures. It is about acknowledging our messy world and arming patients with tools to safely inhabit it. Right now, it's about helping patients redefine health as more than simply not getting COVID. Health also means accepting that living is about more than simply not dying, end quote. So listeners, how has your evaluation of risk evolved? What concerns do you still have? My guest this hour is Dr. Lucy McBride, a practicing internist in Washington, D.C., and the author of a popular COVID newsletter. Dr. McBride, welcome back to the program.
Evan, thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
I really do believe my mother would drive up here and just smack me and say, come in for Christmas. You missed it last year. I'm vaccinated. You're vaccinated. We'll deal with it. That's what my mother would say, undoubtedly. And I have no doubt that there are people whose mothers or vulnerable family members would say, you know what, we can do this over Zoom again. I think that's probably all fine. Let people decide. But I guess I was surprised that the CDC is still sort of leaning on, hey, if you can do a virtual celebration or all outdoors, because I think a lot of people are probably not going to hear that very well. I wonder what you think.
I think you're right. Well, first of all, let me just tell you that you and I have mothers that must be separated at birth.
Mm-hmm.
My mom would say the same thing. I mean, even before we were vaccinated, for our family, like for many families, togetherness is important. And of course, when we did Thanksgiving last year and holidays last year, we were mostly outside and took extreme precautions when we had to go inside for brief jaunts. But this year, you know, we have a completely different landscape in terms of public health. We have three extraordinarily effective vaccines. They are safe and do an incredible job preventing death, hospitalization, and severe disease. And moreover, people are exhausted from vigilance on COVID-19. And, you know, we have to remember, as you well know, that health includes connecting with other people. Our mental health collectively and individually has suffered as a result of isolation, loneliness, and, you know, the absence of these normal rituals. So, you know, I think the CDC is just taking the very most cautious posture as possible. But the problem is, as you just said, people are scoffing at it, and it, you know, runs the risk of eroding credibility in our public health institutions, when the reality of the matter is that the rubber has met the road, and it's time to really dust off our pre-pandemic instincts and risk tolerance and figure out what works best for us, as you said.
Well, with kids in COVID, you know, that's the next step in vaccination. Could be coming, you know, within the next month or so, a green light for at least a Pfizer vaccine for kids 5 years old and up. And I want to start with what we know about risk there. New York Times reporter David Leonhardt explains at length today that we now know that unvaccinated children are less at risk from COVID than vaccinated adults roughly age 65 and older. Leonhardt writes, quote, for those without a serious medical condition, for those kids without a serious medical condition, the danger of severe COVID is so low as to be difficult to quantify. For children with such a condition, the danger is higher, but still lower than many people believe, end quote. And yet when I shared his writing this morning on Twitter, Dr. McBride, I was accused of not caring about the health of children and wanting to experiment with kids' lives by some. Why do you think we're still, I think, kind of struggling to accept that it's not that there's no risk. I hope no listeners hear me saying there's no risk. I don't want anybody to get COVID. I don't want kids to get COVID. But why do you think we're struggling to kind of get our heads around the fact that kids continue to do way better with this than adults?
You know, it's a fascinating phenomenon because, you know, like you, I well understand that there's a continuum of risk. I don't judge people for having risk tolerances that are different from me. In fact, if I judged, shamed, and blamed my patients for having different risk tolerances than I do on various issues, I would really not have any patients to counsel about healthy habits and behaviors. But I think it's that, you know, this is, I think it's this phenomenon where, you know, recall the days in March, April, May, 2020, where we really didn't know much about this virus. We were washing down our milk gallons. We were, you know, wiping down doorknobs. We were terrified to be in the presence of other people. The fear that was embedded in our sort of beings has taken for a lot of people a long time to work itself out. I mean, I think we've been marinating in anxiety and fear and uncertainty and unpredictability for 19 months. And for people with young kids, I mean, my kids are teenagers now, but when I was a parent of kids who are younger, you know, my anxiety and fear barometers were a bit different back then. I think as you get older and you see your kids facing other risks in their lives from driving cars and dating and, you know, going to parties where they're underage drinking, I mean, you can develop a little bit more of a perspective on risk. At the same time, you know, parents have a right to be worried about their kids. There are certain kids who are at highest risk for poor outcomes from COVID, like kids with obesity, kids with certain developmental issues. And, you know, to say that kids are generally low risk is cold comfort when your child is in the hospital with COVID-19. But again, it comes down to the acceptance, which I'm talking about in this piece, which is accepting that the world is risky, accepting that we face risk everywhere we look, accepting that, remember, we face the risk of flu and RSV every year and didn't close down schools. We didn't mask kids in classrooms. So it's really a good time right now as we start to really contain this virus to remember what risks we tolerated before the pandemic and to remember also what health means, which is more than simply not getting a virus, which to kids is generally low risk.
Listeners, as we go throughout this hour, we're going to talk a little bit more in depth about what it means to come to an acceptance that COVID is likely to be endemic, what that definition actually means, what it means for how much we will or won't have to think about it, and what life is sort of likely to be like and how we make those adjustments. And I am curious to know how people are thinking about that. I mean, have you come to a kind of acceptance? Are you feeling optimistic with kids' vaccines on the horizon? Are you is your kind of social calendar permanently altered? Are you right back to where you were before? It's 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Or you can email the program connections@WXXI.org. And people ask Dr. McBride all the time, should I let my kid play sports? How about sleepovers? What about going to parties? You wrote this week that you can't answer that for other families necessarily. It's really got to be up to them and their own risk calculus. But I would like you to explain a little bit more about how you help people think through their options.
So the first thing we do is talk about the facts, right? It always comes back to the facts and the data. And that's, you know, a combination of looking at the data on COVID and how likely it is to, you know, get infected in the region where you live and what the chances of getting extremely ill are if you did get exposed and then infected, and then looking at the unique patient in front of me. So, you know, there's so many variables as we humans relate to the external world, And moreover, people have different risk tolerances, which is exactly why I can't prescribe sort of a one-size-fits-all set of behaviors for all people. But for parents of kids who are unvaccinated, for example, I will, you know, if the kid is healthy, and again, I'm not a pediatrician, and I always defer to my excellent pediatric colleagues for specific advice, I will say, look, you know, outdoor transmission, for example, is really just not a thing. Is it possible? Absolutely. Could it happen? Sure. It's just that, you know, the most assiduously done contact tracing studies have shown that outdoor transmission just isn't likely. Moreover, kids need to be outside, unmasked, socializing, exercising for their overall health. You know, when you're talking about sleepovers and indoor gatherings with unvaccinated kids, you do add risk. If you live in a state where, you know, vaccine rates are low and COVID is surging, you're more likely to have a kid who's asymptomatically carrying COVID-19 or coronavirus and, you know, unwittingly spread it to someone in that, you know, basement, you know, staying up late watching TV. So, you know, it really comes down to, you know, again, risk tolerance, what you're comfortable with, and recognizing, again, that health is about our physical health and our mental health in tandem. I think you would agree, Evan, that, you know, this is a parallel pandemic of mental health and crisis. And even if your child is not in crisis, or your patient, in my case, is not in crisis, we've all suffered in some way. The loss of the contours of our regular life, the loss of friendships, the loss of social connections, the loss of, you know, normal classroom experiences, those are losses that may not cause, you know, mental illness, but they are certainly affect us emotionally. And those things need to be weighed into the decision that you make for how you want to construct your everyday existence.
Yeah, and I'm already dreading the culture wars reaction to the coming green light for vaccinating children, because we know it's coming. I mean, it turns out everything in this pandemic is sort of politicized and culture warred, and it's coming for kids at least over the age of 5, potentially very soon.
Right.
So how are you thinking about the value and the debate about vaccines for kids, one shot, two shots, you know, what we know so far?
Oh, gosh. I mean, this is where, you know, this is going to be, as you just said, an enormous culture war, unfortunately, because, as you know, the pandemic has been so politicized. I think if we lived in a perfect world, which we, of course, don't, and if we lived in a place where there was trust in public health institutions and trust in vaccinations, and we had, you know, every adult over the age of 16 or 12 vaccinated already, we wouldn't need to vaccinate kids because we would have contained this virus a lot earlier. But I think the reality is we live in a heterogeneous country. We have the virus still taking lives and causing, you know, disease and destruction. And so I think, you know, to protect kids, they're going to need to get vaccinated. But of course, it's going to be a nuanced conversation between family and patient, if they're old enough to have that conversation, and pediatrician, because, again, you have to balance the risk of COVID-19 against the very, very teeny, teeny, teeny risk of the vaccine itself, which, you know, I think we'll see in the data is very safe in kids as it is in adults, particularly because the dose is going to be smaller. But I think, you know, this is where, again, pediatricians will shine, and they will need to have shared decision-making with the family.
There was reporting in the New York Times as well recently about the debate about kids getting one shot instead of two in the UK or other countries, and that there is some, you know, I think mild debate in this country about whether the recommendation should go that way, primarily for the reasons we've talked about. Kids do much better with COVID generally, even when they're unvaccinated. And also, there's after the second shot, especially of mRNA, there is some increased risk for something called myocarditis, which is not something that most of us think a whole lot about. So can you, what is myocarditis?
So myocarditis is inflammation of the heart muscle itself, which, by the way, can be a consequence of COVID-19 itself. And in general, so far, based on what we know, there is this signal, this increased risk of transient muscle inflammation in the heart, myocarditis, in teen and young adult boys, but it's still very, very, very uncommon, and arguably the benefit of the vaccine far outweighs the risk even in teenage boys. But I will tell you, as someone who understands that science is an iterative process and that we are still learning, and, you know, anyone who says they're certain about anything in a pandemic, I don't trust. I'm still awaiting, as many people are, more data on myocarditis, particularly in boys. But, you know, if I had a 5 to 11-year-old child right now, I would vaccinate that child for sure. I would give one dose, and I would think hard about number two. That's my honest answer, and it's not to be confusing or controversial. That's just my honest answer about what I would do myself.
Yeah, my 9-year-old's ready. He's ready. He's ready. Yeah. He'll be first in line if he can get it. But I also understand, you know, I understand why this conversation's happening, and what I would like to see is kind of a reset in the discourse, in that,
for sure.
You know, a chance to kind of catch our breath and say, okay, let's talk about why it's valuable in ways that answer questions, knowing that people will have questions. I think people really struggle. People who are sort of uber educated and vaccinated and have been for months struggle with the fact that there are adult Americans who still have valid and unanswered questions about vaccination generally. Because some people think, well, everybody should know by now. If you don't know by now, what's wrong with you? But there are still people who are not vaccinated who go to some of these events, and, you know, they've got questions about all kinds of things, and they just maybe haven't gotten the information yet. It's hard to believe for some people, but it's true.
I mean, so I know I've talked to many people in my practice, even, and in my community, because I, you know, much to my kids' chagrin, will sort of strike up a conversation just about anywhere about the vaccine, and, you know, not to be forceful about my opinions, but just ask if people have any, if somebody has any question, like the checker at the grocery store, a mailman. I just sat on the front stoop, chatted with him for about an hour a couple of days ago, and you know, there are a lot of really, really smart people who just have questions, who have hesitancy that is rooted in, you know, a real either distrust of medical institutions or distrust of doctors, or they are, you know, hearing the kind of shaming and blaming rhetoric in the public square about people who are just deciding not to get vaccinated. And that does not do anything to build trust or motivation to get vaccinated. So, as you said, you know, having non-judgmental, you know, open conversations with people is really the way to build trust.
Mm-hmm. Talking to Dr. Lucy McBride, a practicing internist in Washington, D.C., the author of a popular COVID newsletter whose new piece for The Atlantic is called A COVID Serenity Prayer. And I want to talk about this acceptance idea. I mean, that's what the Serenity Prayer is all about, the acceptance to, you know, to understand what you cannot change, and the wisdom to know the difference. And Dr. Ellie Murray recently wrote about giving up on zero COVID, and she was rather critical of that. I want to read some of what she wrote first. She wrote, quote, "In the beginning of any pandemic, we have four options for what could happen. One, continually occurring disease with small or large surges. Two, local elimination of disease. Three, global eradication of disease. And four, complete extinction of the pathogen," end quote. Before we get to more of what she said, is that a fair breakdown of what happens in a pandemic?
Yeah, I think it is a fair breakdown. I think it is. And I think, you know, the way these things play out, of course, depends on the nature of the virus and its interplay with the host. And we've learned, you know, over the last 19 months that there are a number of reasons why COVID zero is not attainable. Number one, there are breakthrough infections, right? Pre-Delta, we knew that, but Delta showed us for sure that, you know, even if you've been vaccinated with these extraordinary vaccines, you can still get infected and sick. Number two, there are animal reservoirs for the virus. So even if we mopped up the virus in all human beings, you still see it in animals. And number three, it's a highly transmissible virus and is spread by asymptomatic people, people who don't know they even have it. If this was spread only by people who are sick and you could quickly identify someone by, you know, if you're sick, you go into your room and seal yourself off, this would be a different situation altogether. But the toothpaste is out of the tube now. And it's just, it's COVID zero is not attainable. That does not mean we need to accept ongoing death and destruction. Acceptance does not mean we align with or agree with, you know, mass casualties whatsoever. It means facing unpleasant realities of the world we live in.
All right, so let's talk a little bit more about that then, because I think what Dr. Murray is concerned about, Dr. Ellie Murray is concerned that when people say, well, it's just going to become endemic, she seems to think that people are concerned that relegates COVID to some sort of non-entity, not a factor, no impact. So here's what how she describes endemic COVID. She says, quote, "This is easier short-term, but it's the hardest long-term option. It's also super vague. It could mean anything from hundreds or thousands per day to one or two deaths per year. The other name for this is, you guessed it, endemic. You might have noticed something important here, and it's something I think many of the people shrugging off COVID becoming endemic get wrong. Endemic does not mean harmless. Endemic does not mean never think about COVID again. It's exactly the opposite. Endemic means someone is always thinking about COVID. Endemic means public health is always monitoring disease and always intervening when cases cross the acceptable level. Yes, eradication is hard, but we could still choose to make it our moonshot if we wanted to. It would definitely take time. It would probably take new science, new ideas, and new tools, and it would take both leaders and everyday people actively committing to doing what it takes." End quote. That last part you seem to disagree with. You seem to think you can make it a moonshot. It's not going to happen.
Well, Evan, look, I really respect Ellie. I think that we just differ in a lot of areas. To try to eliminate COVID-19, to eradicate it from the planet, or to, you know, simply eradicate it from the United States, would take such, there would be such a social, economic, health toll on human beings that the harms, in my opinion, would outweigh any potential benefit. And moreover, I just don't think it's possible. I mean, when you see patients every day, as I do, who are suffering from, you know, the collateral damage from pandemic restrictions, from weight gain, substance use, you know, social isolation, you know, skipping cancer screenings, you know, shelving their underlying health to be able to protect themselves from this single virus, you realize how broad and vast health is. It's not just about protecting against one single disease. I will also clarify, and I think she was saying this in her argument. Yes, endemic does not mean we're blasé about disease. I mean, the flu is endemic. I get my flu shot every year. If my kid is sick, we immediately sort of isolate them and try not to get the rest of the family sick, because we know that even though, you know, we are probably, my immediate family is not high risk for poor outcomes from the flu, if someone in the family had the flu, they could also spread it to someone who is high risk. So endemicity and acknowledging it does not mean being blasé about COVID or being ignorant about the ongoing destruction that it can cause. We have to decide as a society what level of disease and destruction we are, quote unquote, comfortable with. And I think what we've learned through the last 19 months is that we probably shouldn't be comfortable with the amount of death and despair that flu causes every year. I mean, every year it's somewhere between 20 and 40,000 American lives are lost to the flu. You know, that's too many. We didn't close down schools. We didn't mask kids in classrooms. And I don't think we should do that in flu season from here on out. But we can use this pandemic as an opportunity to be safer in other ways, which I outlined somewhat in my piece. You know, being someone who faces the unpleasant realities of our existence is not synonymous with ignoring, you know, suffering. In fact, being realistic about what humans are capable of, to me, is the birthplace of health.
Mm. Well, and if we look at a couple of places that have done even more significant restrictions than we've seen here, I think maybe there are some lessons. And I have to say, I mean, the restrictions are always worth talking about cost benefits, and maybe we didn't do that very well early on. I think we're doing a little bit better lately, but, you know, we haven't locked down in this country the way certainly China, but also many Asian societies. And if you look at South Australia, that's the place where there's real dystopia, scary stuff.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, to me, that is a frightening picture that I don't think anybody would really want to pursue. Whereas New Zealand has been a lot more about public buy-in. The public respect for the leadership there has been very high. And it's been a society that has a geographic advantage, I should say. And they've kept COVID at bay for a long, long time, but even recently kind of announced, hey, we did our best for a long time, but we're going to have to live with the fact that there's going to be some community spread there, which was a shock to some observers who are not in New Zealand. But even that approach didn't do it forever. So I just don't know, as much as I respect Dr. Murray here, I don't, and it's Ellie Murray, not Dr. Elizabeth Murray, who's been on this program many times. As much as I respect Dr. Ellie Murray, I don't know what could be realistically done if what you're looking at even in New Zealand has not been effective.
That's right. And as you just said, places like, you know, Denmark, for example, which has done well with COVID, generally speaking, you know, it's just a different cultural milieu. They have much more trust in public health institutions. They trust each other more than, sadly, Americans do. And, you know, this is America, for better or for worse. And I think that we have to be eyes wide open to the fact that, again, we have polarized and politicized science, unfortunately, and we have sort of laid bare the heterogeneity of the country. And, you know, that's a good thing, right? Diversity is an excellent thing. But when it comes to science and trust in public health institutions and trust in facts, and not to mention the, you know, we've had so much misinformation and disinformation spread, you know, I think it's unrealistic to expect that people are going to lock down indefinitely, that we're going to mask kids in classrooms indefinitely, that we're going to, you know, close down our economy. I just think, you know, the harms there, in my mind, outweigh the benefits. Here's the thing at the end of the day, Evan, we can practice hope and caution together. It's this concept of holding paradox. We can be anxious and afraid of a virus, you know, in an appropriate way, and we can live our lives. There's no either or here. I mean, health and practicing medicine is really about marrying, you know, caution with living. It's not about either or. And that's really the definition of health is figuring out how to thread that needle between, you know, restricting yourself from things and activities that might cause harm, knowing what you need to be healthy, and, you know, taking risks that you have to take to be human in order to benefit your overall health.
Talking to Dr. Lucy McBride, who wrote the new piece, A COVID Serenity Prayer, which we'll link to if you want to take a look at. And we've got some listener feedback on the other side of this only break of the hour. We'll read your emails to connections@wxxi.org. Listeners, if you want to call the program, I know we've been in the middle of our fall membership campaign, so I've got to get the numbers untangled in my brain. It's 844-295-TALK, toll-free to call this program, 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. It's easier to email. It's connections@wxxi.org, and we'll get to some of your feedback on the other side here. I'm Evan Dawson. Wednesday on the next Connections, the less is more law has been controversial, with some law enforcement leaders say this parole supervision law is going to make communities less safe. But supporters, including some in law enforcement and in prosecution, say that misunderstands the point entirely, and they will explain. We'll talk about the debate Wednesday.
This is Veronica Volk from WXXI News, and we've got a new weekly podcast for you. It's called Earshot, and it's got all the most important, best told, sometimes off the beaten path news stories from your favorite WXXI and city reporters. Earshot comes out every Friday. Don't miss it. Subscribe wherever you find your podcasts.
This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. How have your own calculations of risk regarding COVID changed? And we're talking about how you assess behavior going forward, whether it's holiday planning, just regular decision making with you and your family, how you evaluate facts, information, and some of the research about COVID and safety. And we're doing that with Dr. Lucy McBride. Here is an email, and the writer asked to remain anonymous. Quote, I am a home health occupational therapist who managed to avoid being exposed for the last 19 months. My friends made fun of me for my hypervigilance. This past spring and summer, we have gone to my in-laws' small outside gatherings more frequently. However, I had a direct COVID exposure when hanging out with two of my best friends outside and still had to miss 2 days of work to get a negative test result. Time off is no longer covered under the federal programs. Therefore, anyone who goes out of work while awaiting testing will need to use their personal paid time off. With that said, I'll be going back to being hypervigilant about who I'm hanging out with and what settings that I'm letting my almost six-year-old hang out with as well. Signed, still confused and waiting for younger kids' vaccination approval. Dr. McBride, what do you make of that?
You know, I think there are so many excellent points there to break down. First of all, I think that, as we talked about earlier, everyone has the right to have their own personal risk tolerance, and that's completely fair and justified. One thing that springs to mind is how desperately we need, you know, rapid antigen testing to be, you know, readily available, affordable, accessible to all, so that we can avoid these sort of unnecessary quarantines. You know, CDC even says, you know, vaccinated people do not need to quarantine after an exposure because, well, I mean, I'm guessing what they're thinking, but because the risk of severe outcomes from COVID-19, even if you were infected, is so unlikely in people who've been vaccinated. But it would be really nice to not have to take off work. And I don't know if you need to, unless your workplace mandates it, awaiting the result of a test. What would make more sense is what they're doing in many schools and for example, Massachusetts, which is this test to stay protocol. And those are that's for unvaccinated kids. But certainly for vaccinated people, it would make sense to have a policy where you could take a rapid antigen test every day before work if you had been exposed. And if you're negative, you go to work. If you're positive, then you back it up with a PCR test and you would stay home and call yourself an asymptomatic carrier. If you didn't have symptoms. My point is that we need to have better tools for the public to be able to stay at work, stay at school. And so we don't have to have this massive life disruption, because ultimately, you know, that counts as health too. I mean, that's enormous. That's an enormous toll that is not necessarily needed.
Yeah, paid time off, I think, is a real problem.
Yes.
Here. You know, the person who emailed had to use paid time off just to await positive test results. And paid time off is an issue. The cost of rapid tests, I mean, $25 for a two box, which
too much.
Which, by the way, Dr. McBride, I had a friend who needed to get a rapid test, you know, sort of for peace of mind. She was coming off some mild cold symptoms, and we were going to be in a little caravan down for a little weekend trip. And she wanted, for the group's sake, to say, hey, my, you know, mild little sniffle stuff isn't some sort of COVID manifestation. And so goes out, gets a two-pack. If you haven't seen the two-packs, the result kind of looks like a pregnancy test with one line or two.
Yeah.
But you get these little vials of solution. Well, one of the vials was empty. You know, so it's like, now I just blew $25 on a one-pack. And
yeah.
Boy, these are quickly becoming tools for people with resources. And the most effective testing, as Dr. Mina has been telling us since August of last year or earlier, we're not really making it accessible. I don't know if that'll change soon, but this does not seem sustainable to me.
It's absolutely not. And the federal government has luckily invested a large chunk of money in rapid testing. But you're right. Michael Mina has been touting this technology, rightfully so, for well over a year. And it's sad that it's only now just starting to catch on, and still is expensive and inaccessible to most. I mean, I went online and couldn't find rapid tests. I mean, because they're sold out in most places. But the point is, you know, absolutely, if you're exposed, you should practice more caution. But if we had access to rapid tests, you could do a test and stay protocol, which then might allow you to engage in more social activities if you weren't so worried about exposure and losing time at work that wasn't paid.
Yeah, or even just holiday planning. I mean, I'm going to take a rapid test before I go see my mother. You know, my mom is definitely in the vulnerable category. She'll be boosted by then, I'm sure. But I want to know just to be sure, because that makes me, that's one of the things that makes me nervous. I'm not nervous for me. I'm not nervous for my son. I'm nervous for my mother. I'm nervous for people, even vaccinated, vulnerable, older people. I'm nervous for. So that's what would be really helpful to me. And I wonder by the holiday time, which is coming up fast, how fast this federal rollout of more accessibility is going to happen. Because I think that's really, really key here. But most people not only haven't done it, haven't taken a rapid test, Dr. McBride, but it's interesting. When we talk to people about it, you know what's sort of, I'm sure you know this, what's embedded in sort of the public opinion about rapid tests is people often say, oh, well, you know, they're not very accurate, or, you know, they're not as accurate.
Right.
That is something that Dr. Mina has been pulling his hair out for so long. Can you explain to listeners why that is maybe not the right way to think about rapid testing?
So rapid testing is an extraordinarily useful tool and arguably more useful than the PCR test in many ways, because basically a rapid antigen test like the Binax Now is what I would call a contagiousness test. It is very, very sensitive in the high 90% for levels of virus in your nose that are detectable enough to be infectious to other people, to infect other people. So if you test negative for COVID on a rapid antigen test, even if you don't have symptoms, the chances of you having enough virus in your nose to infect other people is extremely low. The PCR test, on the other hand, is, you know, much more cumbersome, right? Because it has to be run in a lab. It's expensive. There's a wait time. The PCR test is so sensitive that it will be positive in some people who had COVID for up to 12 weeks after their infection. So, you know, it is very sensitive. So, like, you know, 3 to 5 days after an exposure to someone with COVID, you'll turn positive on a PCR test before the rapid test turns positive. If you think about the sort of the curve, the kinetics of the virus, you'll capture with a PCR test very small bits of virus that, you know, maybe you haven't even developed symptoms yet. But even if you're asymptomatic, that rapid antigen test should turn positive if you have enough virus in your nose to infect other people, which is why it's such an effective tool for test and save programs in school. If you have a kid who's unvaccinated, or even if they're vaccinated, who tests negative after an exposure and is, you know, again, feels fine, then they should be able to go to school, because they're, even if they're incubating the virus, they don't have enough of it in their nose to infect someone else. So it's an extraordinarily useful tool. Michael Mina, I mean, I've been trying to sing this song as well, you know, cheerlead his message since, I think it was July 2020. But again, the misperception is that they're not that accurate. And they are not that accurate, you know, days after the virus is, you know, going down on its kinetic curve. It's not going to pick up virus in the very first days after exposure, but it will detect very well infectious levels of virus.
Sarah writes to us to say, Evan, I will continue to be more COVID cautious than you are, but I agree with your points here. We need, by the way, I don't think I'm not COVID cautious. I'm the guy who double masked in the grocery.
You're COVID cautious. Yeah.
I'm the guy who double masked in the grocery store until the Bangladesh study. And then I went out and I ordered a bunch of KN95s. But Sarah says, I agree with the points here. We need good data in order to calculate risk. Staying locked in houses is not realistic. We need to talk more about good masks, air filtration systems, and outdoor options. Sarah, I appreciate that. Let's talk about all three of those. Let's start with good masking. Here's something that I don't get. We had the best study ever done on masking come out of Bangladesh now, I think a few months ago now. And I thought, well, that is going to immediately change the prescription for masking, whether it's in schools or else, otherwise. You know, unfortunately, all of our cool cloth masks against Delta don't hang in better as well as they did against the first flavor of COVID. KN95, N95, much better, make a real impact. And so I ordered a bunch, but I still don't see a whole lot of them out there, and I wonder why that is. Can you talk a little bit about that, Dr.
McBride? It's so interesting. That Bangladeshi study was really, really, really interesting. And, you know, the best, you know, randomized controlled trial we've had on masks. And as you know, it showed a benefit of surgical masks, particularly in people who are older, so older than 50. And importantly, it didn't study children. So we can't say that masks, you know, do a great job of preventing COVID-19 transmission in children. It doesn't mean masks don't work. Masks probably do work. And I'm not anti-mask in the slightest. I am pro-science and data-informed medical interventions. But I think it is interesting, as you said, that we didn't shift from cloth mask use to surgical masks. I mean, I've always worn a surgical mask because I have a whole bunch of them in my office, and my kids wear them, and my husband wears them when they're inside in public places. But there are a lot of people wearing cloth masks, which, again, haven't been shown to have great benefit. But are they sort of a symbol of, you know, vigilance? Do they perhaps mitigate transmission? If you were wearing a cloth mask and someone had COVID and coughed right at you, is that cloth mask going to protect you from getting as much of a viral inhalation than you otherwise would have? Probably. I mean, it just makes intuitive sense that it would. But whether or not we should continue to mask kids in cloth masks ad infinitum is a different story. And I think the answer is no.
Mm. Sarah also talks about air filtration systems. Are you satisfied? I mean, that's an expensive fix for a lot, whether it's businesses or otherwise. But are you satisfied that we've learned enough about air filtration and we're going in a better direction?
I mean, this is where I would defer to Joe Allen up at Harvard School of Public Health. I mean, he's sort of the ventilation guru. We've learned that ventilation is really an important mitigation measure. You know, we've proven again and again this virus is aerosolized, and so I think it's crucial. But whether or not that's practically possible to, you know, in schools and in workplaces, you know, as you said, it's expensive. But I think we need to realize that even cracking a window, opening doors, particularly in times where the virus is, you know, circulating more widely, is going to make a difference.
Another listener writes, my exposure to COVID was with a group of all vaccinated individuals. My company's current workplace protocol is that if you are symptom-free, you have to monitor for symptoms twice a day. I unfortunately made the mistake of telling them I had a mild sore throat, which is probably allergy-related, and I had to go get a test. It took me 3 urgent care visits to get tested with a PCR test because of my symptom, technically, of a sore throat. Yeah, I mean, I guess I understand why if you tell an employer that you hung out with people who had COVID and you've got allergy symptoms, I mean, I guess I would want colleagues to get tested. I would. But how difficult it is continues to be not only frustrating, but it can be really costly. And that's one of the things I don't think we've done very well, because not everybody is like me or Dr. McBride or otherwise. There are people who are scared of losing their jobs if they miss a day of work.
Right.
And we're not doing very well with helping them, I don't think. Dr. McBride, what do you think?
Right. Well, as we know, I mean, I have had many patients, unvaccinated and vaccinated, whose COVID presents as a sniffle or cold. That's actually one of the more common presentations. So you do want to take that symptom seriously. But again, this is where rapid tests would be enormously helpful and would help people not have to lose time from work. But again, we just need more access. We need affordability there. That's the main problem there. But we shouldn't ignore cold symptoms, because again, that can be COVID. But what I'm seeing much more commonly, in fact, I just saw someone today, is RSV, adenovirus, rhinovirus. You know, the flu is probably coming, as it usually does, you know, later in the winter. So, you know, we need to be vigilant about all these respiratory viruses, not just COVID-19.
TJ writes to say, every time I have a little bit of cough, even if it's probably from allergies, I immediately think of COVID. It is totally messed with my head. TJ, I can relate to not only that. I can tell you that one of the shows I hosted last week was remotely with a device from home, because I had the mildest, I knew last Wednesday that I had something that felt like it was not just allergies. Like, my ears were a little pressured. I had a little bit of a dry, scratched throat. It wasn't anything that hurt or bothered me, but it was beyond my typical symptoms. And I'm with you, TJ. Like, immediately I go, well, I'm going to get rapid tests. Like I kind of assume it's COVID until I know it's not, just because I want to be careful in terms of protecting people. I just wish testing was, even rapid testing was cheaper and easier. But Dr. McBride, can you talk about TJ's point there about this messing with your head every time, even if you have allergies? We're going to have to get used to that, but we also have to make decisions on two important things. Number one, when do we need a COVID test? For what symptoms? And number two, should you look sideways at your colleagues if they show up at work with those kind of symptoms and they haven't checked it out?
I mean, once again, just to like beat the drum again, this is where rapid testing would be essential, right? So if you get one test that's negative, even two tests that's negative, that increases your sensitivity by a lot. The one test is already very sensitive, particularly in symptomatic people. But I don't blame people for immediately fearing COVID. But we also need to remember that, you know, for most people, a breakthrough infection is manifest as a, you know, mild cold or flu. I think based on CDC's data from the end of September, I don't know if it's been updated in the last week or two, you know, out of 183 million Americans vaccinated, you can see how unlikely it is to be hospitalized or die from COVID-19. Of course, it can happen with a breakthrough infection, but the risk of death is like 0.002% and hospitalization 0.0008%. But even if you're not worried about yourself getting sick, you're worried about infecting other people. Of course, when you are sick, symptomatic with COVID or any virus, you can transmit to other people. That's why we stay home. That's why we, you know, I remember the days of watching TV in my mom's bed on a sick day, watching The Price is Right. I kind of have this lovely association with The Price is Right. And you're doing it for yourself, but you're also doing it to not infect other people. The worry is if you're asymptomatic carrying COVID, are you at risk for infecting other people, even if you've been vaccinated? And the answer is, it's possible. It's just a lot less likely after you've been vaccinated. Do you have the right to give your colleagues the side eye when they're sick at work? I mean, you know, this is going to be a new landscape we're facing. But I think, yeah, I think, you know, like, remember when you used to sit on a plane next to somebody who was coughing? I mean, you know, now I think we need to make sure that, you know, people have access to these rapid tests so they can reassure themselves and other people that they are not carrying COVID. And wouldn't it be nice to have a rapid test for a flu and RSV as well?
How about
those also do harm?
How about no more perfect attendance awards at school or work?
Right. I mean, we need to give people latitude and, you know, paid time off to not go to work sick. You know, it's really difficult for parents to keep kids home who've had an exposure. Again, testing, rapid testing is really, you know, part of the path forward. That and immunizing eligible kids after they've made that decision with their pediatrician. And what also gives me hope is this molnupiravir, this oral antiviral that Merck has developed and that they've applied for emergency use authorization by the FDA. I mean, that could be a real game changer and just add to the arsenal of tools, not to replace vaccination, of course. I'm a huge vaccine proponent, of course, but as another incredible tool to mitigate and the symptoms and to reduce the duration of symptoms from COVID.
Yeah, we had a candidate for local office on this program last week say that molnupiravir is just repackaged ivermectin and they won't admit it, which is not true. But
no.
But I mean, I already have a couple of emails about ivermectin. Anything you want to say about ivermectin?
I would say that I would really love to think that it works, but I just haven't seen any compelling data to show that it's effective. The efficacy data on the molnupiravir is so stunningly good. I mean, it just can't be ivermectin because it's so clearly beneficial, the drop in hospitalization and death. I think it's going to be an incredibly, I think it's really going to change the game, perhaps even more than child vaccinations, to think that you can, let's say we lived in a world where you could get a rapid test that was free or cheap. You get a diagnosis at home quickly after you have a cold. You call your doctor. Maybe they confirm the test or they go through the, you know, rubric of how you got tested and what your symptoms were and then prescribe you molnupiravir. You stayed home until you were symptom free. And then, I mean, that is going to be a game changer.
Mm. In our last minute or so, Dr. Scott Gottlieb has said that he's cautiously optimistic that we're not going to see another massive wave here. That it, you know, COVID is certainly working its way through the Mountain West right now, and we could see, you know, greater spikes as northern states go more indoors for the fall and winter. But he believes that we're going to be in better shape, and we won't see quite the crushing wave that we had not only last winter but this summer in the South. Do you share that optimism?
I mean, I do, and not just because I'm an optimist, but, you know, one of the horrible parts of Delta is that so many people have been infected, right? Like, because it's so highly transmissible, obviously it tragically has taken lives. It also has infected a whole lot of Americans. And as a result, they have developed some level of immunity. So, you know, if you will, one of the, I don't want to say benefits, because it's not like anyone wishes to get Delta or wishes this horrible virus on anybody. But the fact of the matter is that because Delta has infected so many people, and because we are seeing an uptick in vaccination rates in the United States, we are developing more and more population immunity against the virus.
Dr. Lucy McBride is a practicing internist in Washington, D.C., the author of a popular COVID newsletter, and contributes to a number of publications. Her new piece is A COVID Serenity Prayer. Where do you want people to engage with your work, Dr. McBride?
You can look at my website. It's myname.com, lucymcbride.com.
Always appreciate your time. Thank you for being here, and I know we'll talk soon.
Thanks, Evan.
She's going right back to work as an internist. We appreciate that here on Connections. Appreciate all the feedback from listeners and the whole team here. Rob Braden, Emma Stein, Megan Mack, Evan Dawson, saying thank you for listening. We're back with you tomorrow on, yes, member-supported public radio.